Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, first up this morning is the wonderful Colm McInerney, co-founder of Kela and The Frames, and someone who works both solo and collaboratively. Later this month, he's going to be playing at the Baltimore Fiddle Fair with the legendary John Sheehan of the Dubliners, and that's on May the 11th. Good morning, Colm.
Morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for coming in. Listen, did you grow up listening to the Dubliners? What did you learn as a young musician listening, I suppose, to the flourishes and mastery of John Sheehan?
Oh, for sure. I mean, he would have been a huge, I suppose, role model for an aspiring fiddle player. I mean, playing violin in the 70s and 80s was completely, wasn't the hippest of things you could do, going to classical music lessons. John was kind of helped with the rock and roll element.
Now, the first piece you're going to play for us this morning, I think it's a song or a piece that John wrote, and then you heard it at his granddaughter's christening.
Well, he wrote it for his granddaughter's christening, and he hadn't really played it since. And so one day he said, "Oh, do you have a listen to this?" And I fell in love with it. So it's one of those, it was an instant earworm. So I said, "Well, you know, there's the single, John. What are you mad?" I'm going to play this for you. So this is for John.
That's wonderful. And it's Crea's christening. That's a beautiful piece. That's Crea's christening, of course, written by John Sheehan. What's it like, Colm, working collaboratively with other musicians? You know, what are the pleasures?
Well, I think it's something that I've as second nature to me, really. Firstly, coming from a large family, you become very skilled at finding your own silence in a crowd. And I think then spending over 20 years with The Frames, it's a case of you become a skilled negotiator,
yeah,
and a good listener. But I think listening is actually primary to music making, and so I think that's been a huge kind of boon to have that experience, you know. But working with John obviously is a delight. He's a darling.
You're pretty prolific. You've a new album coming out shortly. And it was produced by the great Bill Whelan.
Indeed, yeah, yeah. Myself and Bill was a great happenstance where back in 2016 I was doing a gig in the National Concert Hall at some literary event, and along sidles up Bill, and then just out of the blue then a couple of weeks later I bumped into him at a Notre Dame University event in Kalmar Abbey, and then a number of weeks later I bumped into a gig of mine in Clifton. So it's kind of case of, by the third time it's a case of, okay, well, what's going on? So he'd just reconditioned his tape machine that he hadn't been using for about 15 years, and was looking around for a project to record in the old style, you know, live to tape. I became that project. So the records come about just really organically, and it's been a complete delight working with Bill.
And you recorded it in a pretty famous house.
Yeah, his house has had such a wonderful history. Kate O'Brien, the writer, used to live there, and then Sting once lived there, and now Bill and Denise live there and their family. Beautiful house in Clochnarone and Ranstone and Connemara.
I remember a good few years back, I was lucky enough to interview you and your wife, Sheila, about your son, Darragh, who I think has autism. And then he had just got a new support dog. How is he and how's the dog?
He's doing great, yeah. Darragh will be 16 in July, and we still have Cassie. She's his assistant's dog. And getting Cassie kind of was a turning point for us as a family in our just... being able to, it just opened up a world of possibility. Whereas before, we were quite the options as regards stuff as simple as going to a supermarket was very difficult because, you know, Darragh has Fragile X syndrome and is on the autistic spectrum as well. So kids with Fragile X syndrome and autism as well, oftentimes they're in a kind of constant on the verge of a fight or flight, you know, response. Mm. So they're so kind of social anxiety levels are high at all times. So now that since he got his assistance dog, it means that he can be attached to the dog, and then he holds the handle for the dog as well. But the magical element is that the dog kind of absorbs all of the attention. So instead of him running off, it turns into a social opportunity as well, where he'll kind of, well, have you met my assistance dog, Cassie? And, you know, so all of the... It's really kind of uncanny the effect of, you know, just how calming she is. She's a, you know, really, really special animal.
It's a wonderful relationship, actually, isn't it? That happens.
Yeah. And it's even just when he gets upset, or she'll come over and, you know, put her head in his lap. And, you know, it's incredible. It's kind of sixth sense stuff.
Well, look, you're going to play for us again. And just to tell our listeners, your new album, The River Holds Its Breath, is released on May the 18th. And you're also going to be in Vicar Street on May the 18th here in Dublin.
Yes, the launch gig for the album on my birthday on the 18th of May. And
Happy birthday.
Thanks. It's John's 80th birthday on the 19th of May. So he'll be there too. So we'll be able to sing him a song.
He'll have to have a bigger cake than you.
Of course, twice the size.
And you're going to play for us now, Colm, a piece called Sappho's Daughter.
Yeah, this is a piece I was invited by Theo Dorgan to set one of his poems to music. And I'd like to play this for my dad, who hasn't been well for the past while. So this is for Liam Mafarwain.
Buerchas, thanks so much for coming in today, Colm.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much, Colm. That's Sappho's Daughter there. And of course, you can catch Colm and the wonderful John Sheehan at the Baltimore Fiddle Fair, and it runs from the 9th to the 12th of May. Full details on fiddlefair.com. Thanks so much, Colm. We'll take a break. Well, this week in a landmark court case, Limerick woman Ruth Morrissey and her husband Paul were awarded €2.1 million in damages over Ruth's cervical check smear test. Ruth's been told she has less than 2 years to live. Well, she joins me now on the line from her home in Limerick. Thanks so much for joining me, Ruth. I can only imagine it was a very stressful court case. Listen, congratulations on your win. What did it feel like to win, Ruth?
I'd like to say it was really exciting. I think it was more of a relief. And I think the win for me was more around the labs, and, you know, we won against them, and that was the main thing for me. So it was, I'd like to see you kind of jump up around and, you know, you kind of think, oh, this is fantastic. But it was just a relief that finally the labs were found to be responsible and accountable for negligence on the slides, which was just ecstatic for us.
Yeah, it was wonderful for you, Ruth. And just to, you know, remind people, the case brought by yourself and your husband, Paul, it was the first cervical check case in which a court had actually heard the evidence and delivered a ruling. So it's an important legal precedent, isn't it, that he set?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was tough to go through, but I think it was something that needed to be done eventually anyway with what was coming behind me. Because what it gave an opportunity to unfold, you know, some of the elements that people were not aware about in terms of, you know, the HSC being responsible for the contracts and the overall program itself and the responsibility with the labs as well. So from that perspective, it was very, very important.
Go back, Ruth, will you? I mean, why did you decide to take this case? How did you think of taking it, Ruth?
I think it just happened so quick. Miriam, to be quite honest with you, because I was in the middle of my treatment. And when we found out that I was actually one of the ladies that was impacted, and I think it was 100, about 105 or 8 people at that particular time, we were kind of left in limbo. We didn't know where to turn to. We didn't know, there was nobody there to answer questions for us. So we kind of felt the only ones that we could actually go to had answers that we felt was Keane, my solicitor. Mm. So we just went out to meet them and had a chat with them to discuss, you know, what things were about. We had questions about, you know, is this really a cover-up? You know, do you think the GPs knew about? You know, there were so many unanswered questions and worries from a female perspective, from a family perspective as well. So I think at that particular time, and that's when I found out that I was actually one of the ladies. I was on that list of patients from the doctor here in Limerick. So I just said to Paul, you know, you want to press ahead with this. And we both just agreed to do it.
And that happened, Ruth, wasn't it, after Vicky's case, Vicky Phelan's case?
Exactly, yeah. I think it was a couple of days after Vicky's case.
Listen, go back, if you will, just for my listeners, Ruth, 2009, 2012. I mean, you just went for a normal random smear in 2009. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, your random one when you, when you go in and your doctors, they're going, you know, you're due a smear and you're going, yeah. And you're trying to put it off because obviously it's that the most comfortable procedure that you should have get done, you know, in terms of a dignity perspective, you know yourself, Mary.
Yeah.
But, you know, just normal regular routine, going into your GP just for your checkups and saying you're due your smear and just getting them to do it and, you know, and carrying on with your life. You know, an important program because you knew what the elements and how it would protect you going forward. You know, you knew what it was about, that it was to check, you know, to make sure that you had pre-cancer and stuff like that. So, I mean, I was so important from a health perspective, you know, to get my smears done, and I never missed one. Never ever missed one.
And you did one in 2009, 2012. And as far as you were concerned, they were just fine.
Absolutely fine. Got a letter back to say everything was fine, no abnormalities. We'll see you again in 3 years' time.
And then what happened, Ruth? In 2014, was it?
It was in 2014 I started having symptoms. Mainly just after sex, there was a kind of a light pinky substance, and I would call it like a pink panther type of a blood. Mm. And I would kind of, my husband, I kept telling him there was something wrong with him. not me, that he needs to go and get checked out. So that was kind of going on for a couple of months, and then eventually he just said, will you just go in and get checked just to see what's going on? And I went in that particular day, and the other GP was on, my regular GP, Dr. Boylan, is male, so there's a female doctor on, Dr. Toohey. So she did the smear for me, and when she actually looked through, she could see at the end of the cervix that there was something there. So she did, she just said, look, I'll just do a smear test as per procedure, but I'll kind of try to expedite that to get you out to colposcopy, which she did. I got out to colposcopy within a couple of weeks. They did a sample and said, look, nothing to worry about, just looks like a warty type of a thing. Called me back within 2 weeks and said, yeah, I can take it. So he did, he took samples of it to get, obviously, tested a bit more. You're not to worry about, off you go. And then I think the next day then I was asked to come back, and that was around July, the end of June, because I remember we celebrated my birthday. I went into Dr. Hickey on the 1st of July, went into the waiting room, and there was an older lady there, and then I knew this isn't good. You know, there's an older lady here. It's usually ram-packed of a waiting room, you know, to get the smears of colposcopy done. And I went in to Dr. Hickey, told my husband, nope, stay outside, it's fine, it's just routine. And he told me I had cervical cancer. And I think I shocked and sat there, and you know when you have, you see in the movies where people have, they go deaf and everything else is going on behind them, they have an out-of-body experience. That's basically what happened to me. I just couldn't believe it. So he just said, let me have a quick look, just to have, to see what's going on. Very gentle doctor, he's absolute gentleman, I have to say, absolute gentleman. He checked and said, yeah. So he set me on the chair and he said, look, you're quite young, you're only 33, and we have a chance of preserving fertility. You know, I think tracheolectomy is a good option for you. You know, it won't be menopausal or anything like that. We'll just take the cervix, and if, you know, hopefully if you conceive again, that you will be able to, you know, deliver, but we'll obviously do C-section. So you've already had a C-section before, so it should be fine. That was great. And he just said, look, we don't do that particular procedure in Limerick. There's a guy in Cork, Dr. Matt Ewis, who does it via Da Vinci, robotic, and I'm really into innovation. I thought it was very interesting, you know, that it was done robotically and stuff like that. So I was transferred to Cork, to Dr. Ewis. Kind of still shocked, but they came across to me that it was caught really early, and I was very lucky. And they were very confident in what they were doing, which kind of reassured me that it was going to be fine. You know, so, and that's when we took our journey to Cork.
And then what happened, Ruth?
So then our journey to Cork then, so Dr. Ewis, he obviously did his checks and exams as well, like my MRI done, and he said, yeah, you're eligible for a trachelectomy. And he did mention a hysterectomy as well, but kind of said the pros and cons of both. You know, hysterectomy would be when you went to menopause, you won't be able to conceive again and stuff like that. So, I mean, we were quite happy that we had Libby because she was lucky to be here. So we were very excited that we had her anyway, and blessed that we had one child, very, you know, aware that just some people can't conceive at all. So, you know, we kind of took it back and said, do you know what? What's the best option for us? And I said, you know, I didn't want to be going through the menopause at 33 years of age, you know. And he kind of, you know, very confident and reassured, you know, Da Vinci, fantastic procedure. It's less invasive. Recovery time is better. So kind of that element, we kind of decided to go through the trachelectomy. Now, he kind of pushed us in a way for the trachelectomy, I felt, because what he did mention was he had not had a successful pregnancy with a trachelectomy, but he felt that we could conceive because I was quite young and healthy, and so was Paul. You know,
yeah,
and give it our families. We both came from significantly big families. Paul is from, I'm going to get it wrong now, he's from 11 or 12, and I'm from 10, 11, and I'm from actually 8. So, you know, we both have big families. So, on that reason, we kind of felt that, you know, there wouldn't be a problem conceiving. So,
and Ruth, go on. I was just going to say, Ruth, when did you realise, Ruth, because this is what your court case was about, that in fact, this previous smears, certainly the first one, that's what Kevin Cross decided in his judgment, that that there had been a misreading of your earlier smears, that this could have been found earlier. When did you realise that?
In May of 2018, so last year when I was told about the audit. When we were given the results, we were told that the 2009 smear had made it, would have made a significant difference in my health. And that was shocking because I would have expected one smear, Miriam, but to sit down and see two smears, you're kind of shaking your head going, that's just unbelievable, you know. How unlucky could I be?
And Ruth, in terms of your own health now, what is your diagnosis, Ruth?
So right now, obviously the 2 years is kind of what's been given. But I don't accept that because I'm a very positive person. So I strive to try and find something out there that will help me. It's inoperable. It's making very difficult side effects right now for me in terms of my mobility to walk. Because what happened was, even though I responded well to the treatment last year, it decided to cocoon itself in my body, the tumour itself. So it's made itself a little home. And what happens is it's kind of latched onto the bone and the muscle and it's calcifying. So it's kind of eaten away into the bone and the muscle, which is giving my side effects, my mobility to walk and stuff like that. So,
What you know the way Vicky's on that drug is a Pembroke? I mean, do you use that drug? Does that work for you or not, Ruth?
No, I don't actually know yet, Miriam, if that is an option for me.
Okay.
We haven't gone down that route yet because I went for the alternative options that were available because I have the breast, well, I had the breast cancer as well, you see. So I was in more of a difficult situation. I had two cancer strains, completely different. So, and obviously Pembroke is designed for your immune system. You know, you couldn't attack both because which one would it know to attack itself, you know, because they're both different strains. So I had a completely different situation to Vicky where I had to deal with the breast cancer. So I kind of took it in what I would say. I compartmentalised everything into sections. So like a project. So I had to deal with the breast cancer first. Then I had to deal with the cervical cancer. Then I had to go back to the breast cancer again. So I had to do it in sequences of how we could deal with both. So there was massive decisions around the breast as well to have a double mastectomy. So once the breast is dealt with, maybe future down the line, Pembroke could be an option for me. But right now, I don't know if it is. We have to wait and see as time proceeds. But right now, I'm due to see my consultant next week anyway for a scan follow-up to see where we are.
But in a sense, the last thing, Ruth, you and your husband Paul, and I was reading about your evidence, both of you in the court case, you call him your rock.
Yeah.
It was incredibly moving evidence. The last thing you really needed was to go through a court case. And I know that Taoiseach did say that he hoped no one would go through a court case. So did you feel angry to go through the court case or not?
I was angry, but when I think about it realistically, when I took my... When you go through your emotional roller coaster and you think back and you sit back and you think realistically, you know, he made a promise, ideally, that he couldn't keep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure he had came across in terms of he had, when I say empathy, but he had, you know, kind of, he felt, you know, he was kind of convinced himself that it was an option for us. But when I sat back after a couple of days and thought about it and said, you know, they actually have a right to defend themselves in a court case just as well as I do, you know. So I kind of, after a couple of days, I kind of sat back and went, cop on, this is going to go to trial. And I kind of knew, Miriam, after that my case was going to be the one that was going to go.
And obviously, it's even a tricky question to ask you, given what you've been through and are going through, Ruth. But I suppose he's set this test now, hasn't he, the judge called absolute confidence for the screeners. And there are people saying, lots of doctors saying, oh, this is very scary. It could have huge implications for all screening programs and not just for cervical cancer. What do you say to that, Ruth?
Well, what I would say is, you know, if you're unsure of what you're looking at, then you can't pass that it's been a positive thing. You have to call it negative. You know, if there's any doubt whatsoever, it has to be called negative. And if people have to be in that mindset, I mean, at the end of the day, Miriam, it's not like you're looking at a piece of, looking at a sheet or a slide that has no impact. This is somebody's life that you're looking at, you know, and a slight decision for you to say, oh, that's negative, we can move it on. You know, when there's a doubt there, there's maybe a little cluster on the right side or the left side that you may be unaware of or unsure of, but you still pass it. If there is any doubt, then it should not be passed. It's very simple. I mean, it's not going to clog any systems. It's just going to give more assurance to people that we're going to have a proper screening program, that, you know, people are going to be more vigilant doing it. You know, we're going to have more confident screeners because this is somebody's life that you're looking at.
You sound a remarkable person, Ruth. I mean, lots of our listeners going, Deirdre goes, oh, congratulations to Ruth and her win. She was so right to do what she did, and I wish her and Vicky Feenan all the best. They are heroes and stood up for the women of Ireland. Another David Whelan says, Ruth is one amazing woman, total respect to her and her wonderful family. Wishing her all the very best. You sound extraordinary, Ruth. I mean, what keeps you going? I mean, I know Paul is your rock, as you said in court. And Libby, I suppose, your little girl.
Oh God, you talk about a rock. I don't know more whether I want to call her. She's amazing. I mean, she just from every part, from her head to her toe, and I'm always saying to her, how much do I love you? And she's like, to infinity and beyond, and who's my best friend? And you know, and she's like,
how old is she?
She's 7 and a half. Very important.
Yeah.
She'll be 8 in July. You know, she keeps us going. You know, we're a family unit of three. We three of us love each other very, very much. We do everything together, going to the cinema, walks, movies, trying to get her to go to Thomond Park as much as we possibly can. So we were kind of hoping to go to Ariana Grande, excuse me. But we missed out on the tickets, so that was going to be our first concert. So we kind of sourced 3 tickets for that in September. So hopefully that's on our radar. But no, we're fantastic, the three of us together. She's amazing. Everything about her, you know, we were told, you know, back when she was born that she wasn't going to make, because Libby actually had a left diaphragmatic hernia. So she was actually born in Dublin. So we flag her saying she's a dub every time Leinster and Munster are playing. You have to leave the room. And so we were told she wouldn't survive, and given very minimal chance with her. So she did, and she was home within 10 days. After her repair, so she's a wonderful human being in person. So she keeps us going. She really does.
Well, tell her I'm going to work on those Ariana Grande tickets, okay? I'll do my very best on those.
Final question
to you, Ruth.
Yeah.
You sound so positive. I mean,
yeah.
Is that just something, do you wake up in the morning and just go, I'm going to live every day right now with as much positivity as I can? How do you do that?
It takes a while to do it, and I kind of, it's not like I jump up out of the bed straight away, put my 2 feet in my slippers and off I go. I have to think about it in the morning time, is it going to be a good day, is it a bad day? And you have to convince yourself, Miriam, it's going to be a good day, you know. And don't get me wrong, I have my bad days. There's days where I don't want to get out of the bed and I want to curl up and say, why did this happen to me? Why me? Why did you pick me? Why my family? Why do, you know, what did we do to deserve this? You know, so I have, and I still have those questions, I still have those days, but majority of my days are positive, and they have to be because, you know, you have to have that positive mind frame, because if you don't, you're going to give up and you're going to let it win. And by God, I'm not going to let it win. You know, I'm going to give everything that I can to survive. And I've made a promise to both Paul and Libby at the very start, before any of this came out, when I was first diagnosed with the cervical and the breast cancer last February, that I was going to fight as hard as I could, and that doesn't change anything. And the whole scandal didn't change anything either. It just put a little extra bit of weight on top of it. But you know, life prepares you, Miriam, for things. You know, we've been through an awful lot, so I think that was for a reason, for this day and for these days, to be as strong as possibly as I possibly can.
Well, Ruth, you're a remarkable person, and it's actually a privilege to talk to you. And I hope all goes brilliantly well for you, Ruth Morrissey, and to Paul and Libby. Yeah. And yeah, I won't forget about Ariana Grande. Thanks so much for joining us, Ruth Morrissey.
You're very good. Thanks, Mary. You're very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. We'll take a break. So much reaction there to Ruth Morrissey. Miriam, it's a beautiful day here in Limerick, but the day in life has been made much brighter listening to Ruth. What an inspiration. Margaret in Cork goes, Ruth is an incredibly brave, strong woman. Having been let down by the institutions we're expected to trust, she remains positive and determined that she had to go through the huge stress of a court case because our government once again lacked basic humanity is a tribute to her. Best regards to her. Now joining me in the studio is playwright, poet and novelist Frank McGuinness, long referred to as one of our greatest living writers. He's just been awarded UCD's prestigious Ulysses Medal to add to his many, many, many awards and accolades, from early plays such as The Factory Girls and Observe the Sons of Ulster to a new poetry collection which is going to be published this summer. He's still writing and telling stories which have been described by UCD as prodigious, restless, all-encompassing and relentlessly questioning. And Frank McGuinness, good morning.
Good morning, Miriam. Thank you very much for that.
You never change. You look exactly the same as you did 30 years ago. I don't know what you're on.
I made a pact with some evil demon to look exactly as ugly as I ever did.
No, you look great. Listen, first of all, the Ulysses Medal. I was actually looking up your awards. You have about 150 million awards. So what does this mean to you?
This was extremely special. I went to UCD in 1971 as a student of arts. The arts building had just moved from Earthward Terrace to the wilds of Belfield, and believe me, it was a wild, desolate place in 71. And so an awful lot of my life has been invested there, my academic life and my private life. And it really is very special to get this recognition named after the Ulysses, after Joyce's great novel. It touched me deeply. My folks came from London and from Donegal for it, and the department and the institution did me proud. It was a lovely day. So it was a great way to just acknowledge how important the place is to me, and I'm delighted that they felt that I had contributed as a teacher as much as anything, as a writer. So it was good.
Oh, listen, go back to Buncrana. Tell me about your childhood, your parents, where you grew up and about it.
I grew up in the town of Buncrana, which by Donegal standards is quite a big town. It's second to Letterkenny, and they never cease to remind us of that. Nor do we cease to remind them that we're nearer to Derry. My family were working class. My father was a breadman. He had his own van. He delivered bread around on his own. My mother was a shirt factory worker, as were her sisters and her mother. It was a very close-knit community. It was a very big family, extended family. I had loads of cousins, uncles and aunts. It was a classic Irish Catholic childhood, and we were well looked after. We didn't have much money, but we were extremely closely protected. And I mean protected, because we were close, so aware of the water beside us, the Atlantic Ocean, and the great pastime was going to the shore at all times of the year, but we were never let into the water. Ever. So we were growing up with this sense of security and this sense of fear. And then in my adolescence, the north erupted, and Derry, as I say, is 10 miles or 14 miles across the border. So you have this weird mixture of absolute security and absolute insecurity, which was which did your head in, but it was very good for writing.
And even the Factory Girls, there were strong female influences in your life, weren't there?
Oh yeah, very much so, actually. My mother and all her sisters, as I said, worked there, and they were terrific, witty, intelligent women who had a great command of language and a great pride in their work. And that was communicated to us from mother's milk, effectively. And we grew up in our granny's house. She did the minding for us when our mothers were working. So like all this array of cousins were like brothers and sisters to us. Plenty of noise, plenty of fights. My poor grandmother, thinking back on it, she must have the patience of a saint to deal with this, but she did deal with this. And believe me, you didn't cross her. So I was used to toeing the line when it came to when I you know, Leslie O'Donnell give the word that she were told, and that was it.
And actually, you said to me at Larry before we came into you that you sometimes think your dad slightly got overlooked, because obviously you've spoken about the strong women. Tell me about your father.
My father was a bread man, and he was quite very adept at driving. He was driving from the age of about 12 lorries and various things that his father had a business. And so they had these vehicles. And my dad got one of the businesses, which was the bread business. And he and my aunt Sadie ran that. And looking back on it, I didn't realise at the time, but I mean, he must have been making reasonable money, but we didn't know that actually. It was the time when men didn't talk about what they earned and their wives didn't know. He earned enough to, my mother stopped working when I was about five and my sister came along, she effectively wasn't working for about 7 or 8 years. But then my father went into a terrible darkness. He had a profound breakdown, and we lost everything. We didn't lose the house because it was a council house, but we lost everything. It had an appalling effect on my adolescence, I have to say. He never really came entirely out of the darkness. He got used to much that was sorrowful in his life, and he coped with it, and we all coped with it. But I now look back on it with great admiration for him, that he kept going. And indeed, in the new book of poems, The Wedding Breakfast, my father is so powerfully present in so many of them that it came as an enormous shock when I was reading the proofs that for once, actually, my father is the dominant parental force in this book. And I think maybe now, hitting 65 myself, I'm at long last able to recognise his love for me, and I'm at long last able to recognise the struggle that he went through, the mental struggle that he went through, just to keep surviving.
And I think we're going to hear a poem, maybe. What poem in
this
relation
to your
dad? This
is the very first poem in the collection, and it does in its way reflect myself and himself, and it's called Trains. That could be me, the red-haired man, leading his child, his red-haired child, down the aisle of the moving train, travelling to Belfast. The child by the hand, the boy looking at the back of his father, holding each other by fingers and thumbs, passing secrets on to each other, secrets they'll tell to the end of days, tucking each other into the clay, reading stories passed from finger to thumb, stories that begin, that end on a train, moving to Belfast, travelling from Dublin, where somebody says to himself, that could be me, the red-haired man, leading his child, his red-haired child.
That's beautiful.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's beautiful. When you left home first and went to the big smoke here in Dublin, you were miserable when you left Buncrana, weren't you?
Absolutely. I'd never spent a day away from the town, never had a day, a night away from it. So it was a terrible shock to the system, physical system, psychic system, sexual system, cultural system. I'd be away from Donegal. And I had a much thicker accent then. They found it very difficult to understand me here. And I found it very difficult to understand them. So I had to spend the best part of about 2 years making up my mind, could I last here? Could I endure here? And UCD actually was the saving of me, because I loved English. I loved the subject that I was studying. I was really encouraged to do better. Not to be as good as I had been, but just do better. This is a different order of work. This is a different demand that was being put on me. And I had wonderful teachers there who were truly inspiring, but also exceedingly tough. And I had to knuckle down and do it. So I had that as a substitute, if you like, for the close family unit. I had now got my studies marked out for me. And it was going to have to happen anyway. You couldn't hang around Buncrana. There was nothing to do. That was the saving of me, coming here and studying.
Who gave you your breaks in writing? Did I read that David Marcus?
David was the first and the best. I was published while I was an undergraduate by him in the Irish Press, the New Irish Writing. And again, he he gave me one of the greatest and happiest shocks of my life when I got a letter back from him saying, you are a writer. And I sent him some poems and then he gave me some notes on how to rewrite them. And this is, of course, the real joy of writing is rewriting. And David was a master at knowing what you had to do, not forcing you into doing it, but leaving it for you to imagine you'd found the solution yourself. So David published me for the next 3 or 4 years, and that was the beginning.
And obviously we mentioned the Factory Girls earlier, but Observe the Sons of Ulster, I love all of your work. I do love that. It's such a... Where did that come from? I know people say when you study all the academic reviews of you, which I've been reading for this, they all say, you know, you're very interested in historical events, but those Protestant guys in World War One, where did that idea come from?
It came from the War Memorial in Enniskillen and the War Memorial in Coleraine, where were the two towns in the north that I was kind of... had most of my interest in. And I went one day and I was to get a lift into... to the college at University of Ulster where I was working. And these names had never really meant anything to me. I'd never made any real emotional content with them. But I was looking at their names and their ages. And then I went in to give a lecture on the history of the language, which, believe me, is not the most inspiring or thrilling of subjects. And I was chatting to these students who were visibly bored. And I was a young lecturer at the time and I wasn't too sure how to deal with visible boredom. Probably still am not. But it suddenly twigged then, my God, they're exactly the same age as the men who went to fight there. And then I thought, if every boy in this class was not there, what ructions, what grief would erupt within the community? And then I made the connection. And that was the beginning of that play. No question of that, that I actually saw that it was, you know, more or less my own generation who were wiped out. And then I wrote The Factory Girls. I got some money from the Arts Council, the dear Arts Council, who let me go up to Coleraine and spend the best part of a year working on it. And that's where it was, actually. I was helped by financial assistance, and I was helped by my own teaching to make the bridge.
And The Gates of God, obviously, about Hilton Edwards and Micheál MacLaymore. Mm. You love them. You love MacLaymore, is it true? Do you have a painting of MacLaymore?
I do, actually. It's not a painting, it's a photograph my friend Fergus Burke took just before he was about to go out to do The Importance of Being Oscar. He caught him in a mixture of panic and repose, and it's there in the house and very important to me. It was one of the first bits of art that I ever bought. And MacLaymore is a great inspiration to me. He's a great man.
Why is he such a great inspiration to you?
I love him for his courage, actually. He and Hilton were, you know, openly a pair at a time when, you know, they ran great risks in being so. They were blackmailed very badly. They were not accepted. And I love the fact of their defiance. I love the fact of their devotion to each other. I love their fights. I love the badness that they got up to with each other. And they just strike me as two of the best you could ever have on your side. And I'm very proud of them.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And also, of course, some of your work, reading your academic reviews, there's quite a lot about being gay or being bisexual. Obviously, you're gay yourself. Mm-hmm. Did it take you long to come out? And how did that go down in Buncrana?
Well, in my own head, it didn't take long to come out because you can't deny the evidence of your own body. But I learnt from a very early age to protect myself. And I also learnt that I didn't really like violence, particularly violence inflicted on me. And I'm very attuned to all forms of violence and violent threats upon me. When you grow up quite a shy kid in a rough environment, which Buncrana was, and you learned how to survive. So you do become very finely attuned to where threats are coming from, all kinds of threat. It means that it's very hard to trust anybody, but it also means you survive.
Which is very interesting. The poem, you're also going to read one other poem that you absolutely love. Mm. Tell me about this.
Shall I compare it to your summer's day?
It's Sonnet 18,
isn't it? Sonnet 18, it's Shakespeare's sonnets. I loved teaching Shakespeare's sonnets. I love them because they're such a great conversation between yourself and himself, the greatest of them all, Shakespeare. And this one is a very atypical sonnet because it is apparently so openly celebratory until you step back a bit and you realise, why are there so many negatives? Why is he saying what it's not, what it is? And then you realise that this love is anything but secure or permanent. It's real love. It's dark, it's dangerous, and it's questioning.
Off you go, Frank.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometimes too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometimes declined, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his leafy shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, our eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
Oh, I love the way you read that. Are you a hopeless romantic, Frank?
No.
Are you not?
Not at all, no.
Oh,
no, I'm a realist when it comes to romance, actually, and I think this is a highly realistic poem in the whole sequence of the sonnets, because, as I say, everything around it and everything after it is so dark and questioning and unlikely. But this one is kind of like a great roar of relief. Well, on this occasion, I can feel secure. But as I say, when you step back, it's anything but secure.
Lots of love on the from people texting in about you, Frank. Miriam, what a powerful account by Frank of his father's struggles and his journey towards a better understanding and respect for what his dad went through. Really enjoying the interview. That's from Evelyn. Another says, Frank's reading of his poem, that poetry would melt the heart. Another says, congratulations to Frank on his recent award. I didn't see his play Observe the Sons of Ulster marching to the Somme, but last August I marched with the Sons of Ulster to the Somme. It was a pilgrimage consisting of some people from the south and many from the north. We saw the graves and remembered the 36 Ulster and 16th Irish Division. Frank is a really great writer. Best. That's from Tom Blake.
Okay, thank you so much, actually. We went there in 2016. I'd never been to it, and the experience is quite overwhelming when you see where they died. It's heartbreaking.
What now? You're as busy. Gee, you still don't travel that much. Did I read that? You know, I know you didn't really like moving from Buncrana to Dublin, but you managed that.
I managed it.
And you're still here.
But still have the accent.
But you're not mad about travelling around the world.
Well,
is
the thing
correct?
Is that I have a very intense response to where I go. And I try to choose where I go with great care. I had an extraordinary experience in Japan, which I adored. I adored the country and I adored the people. But something happened wonderful there, and I can never go back to it because nothing could live up to what took place there. Mm. Similarly, Italy and France I love, but I ration my trips there because I want to continue to have this passion for the place, and I don't want to deaden it with over-familiarity.
So interesting. And you love music. I was lucky enough to interview him a few years ago. You love Burt Bacharach.
Burt Bacharach is a massive hero. I heard him playing in the concert hall about 5 years ago.
And interesting as well, one of your favourite songs is the Cilla Black song.
It
it's
is.
Not your
and
old time.
I loved Cilla, actually. I adore her. First thing I ever had published was a letter in Spotlight magazine confessing I was a big fan of Cilla Black, which, if you can imagine, in a boys' school in the 1960s in Donegal really went down well, actually. They were so enlightened. I was lucky I had to avoid the toilets for a while after that, actually.
Another says, Carmel McQueenie from Kells says, Miriam, I had Frank McGuinness as my lecturer in Maynooth in 1996. I still remember what a wonderful lecture he was. We did Ibsen's A Doll's House.
Yes, that's right, absolutely.
Kathy McKay from Buncrana says, tell Frank that the Mayflowers were strewn as usual on all the doorsteps in the lane on May Day. We still talk about the stories and the fun with the O'Donnells and my aunts and uncles who live next door.
That's Kathleen, Kathleen Coyle as well, actually. And you can, Kathleen, in the new book, will have a photograph of my granny, Cyril Coger and Liza O'Brien on it, and a picture of the Pine Lane.
You seem very happy. Or content. Sometimes when I say to super clever people, they can't go, content, Miriam, but do you enjoy your life?
Well, I mean, I think that getting the Ulysses Medal made me take stock of the fact that I have been blessed by the people I worked with, the people who taught me, and blessed by my family. And I certainly think that, you know, we know enough that life can deliver savage blows. But, I mean, I'm at a stage now where, you know, you're confronting your mortality and the mortality of those you love. So many people are sick at the minute and they're going through terrible procedures. But, you know, I really do have a respect and a gratitude that, you know, I'm able to walk out my own door and use my own two feet and, you know, go into the town and wander about. I'm grateful for that, actually. So I think I'm less of a miserable git than I used to be.
Do you think we get to heaven? Do you believe in heaven?
No, not at all. This is heaven.
That's
this earth is heaven.
And you're still writing as much?
No, actually, the illness last year, which I don't really want to get into, but it did affect my concentration. And I really had to be more careful in how I ration my time. I have done some work for the Abbey. I have this new book coming out. I have an idea for a play. I'll get it down. I'll do it. But I'm not panicking now if I haven't got five things on the go. You know, one is enough. And I'm also very happy. I'm working on a new collection of poems. And that's, I hope, going to come in the next 3 or 4 years, and I hope I'll be around for the next 3 or 4 years to get it finished.
You definitely will. As I said, Frank, you look the same as you look for 30 years.
Thank you, Marianne.
I love talking to you. I also love your speaking voice. You're such a beautiful accent. You've never lost it. Thank you so much for coming in. Congratulations on your Lissette's medal.
Thank you very much. Thank you.